Taking a look now at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest today, as he always is, on the first Wednesday of every month. And we invite you to join in with your questions and comments about the wildlife in your area. Or maybe you've got just a general question about wildlife. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Scott, good to have you back.
It's great to be here, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you. And I wasn't as the happiest of holidays for some of our deer hunters here in the state of Wisconsin this year. The numbers are down from previous years.
Yes, I suspect this will be a major topic today, but we'll see which way the listeners want to go. It's true that yesterday the preliminary harvest estimate was released for the traditional 9-day Thanksgiving hunt, and the number was 195,647, which is, I mean, on the plus side, that's a lot of deer. That's a lot of deer. So, I mean, that's a great harvest, but it was down from last year's harvest for the same period, which was, let me find it here, 276,895. So it was down almost 30%, 29.4, I think, to be exact. So, you know, some of the rumblings we've been hearing from hunters or landowners that they weren't seeing many deer certainly, I guess, were borne out, especially in some northern parts of the state. So we'll see what all this means, and that number will be refined somewhat. And that certainly isn't the only season.
Right.
Wisconsin deer hunting now is characterized by almost continuous opportunity from mid-September to the first of the year.
Yeah.
We're in the middle of the muzzleloader season as we speak, and then a week from this weekend is another antlerless hunt. And then there's a holiday hunt, and the bow season's back in place. So, I mean, there's still ample opportunity. But I think no matter what other opportunities are out there, I think the mindset of probably the public and most hunters is that the deer hunt, so to speak,
is the
9-day traditional Thanksgiving week hunt, and that's when the bulk of the deer are taken, and that's what shows this rather dramatic decline, which wasn't entirely unexpected. So it's no huge surprise, but that doesn't make it any less easy for the hunters who were unsuccessful to take.
So still with 600,000 plus licenses sold, that's still 1 in 3, roughly.
It's still 1 in 3, and overall, even in the more recent years where we had record or near-record harvest, it was not like everybody was getting a deer. It was still less than 1 in 2 because some people were taking multiple deer. So
yeah.
It's still – don't get anybody wrong here or misinterpret this. There are lots of deer being taken, just not as many as in recent years, but this may represent as the herd diminishes, and by design – and by need in many areas, we're looking in some parts of the state at the new reality. So,
Brooke in Eau Claire has a question for you, Scott. Brooke, hello.
Hi there. Two quick questions. One is, why are the moles working everywhere the last couple weeks?
Mm-hmm.
And the second question, hunters always getting those, wanting to get the bucks. Doesn't that hurt the gene pool, them taking out all the biggest bucks? Thank you.
Well, let's take the second second question first. There's always been some concern about that in terms of, gee, if they all strive to get the biggest and best, doesn't that reduce or hurt the gene pool? But in reality, when you look at the distribution of sex and age classes within this 200,000 deer or all the deer that are eventually taken, the proportion of trophy magnificent bucks is still very, very low.
Very low.
And lots of does, lots of fawns, lots of yearling bucks. So while that's an oft-expressed concern, and while it may be an issue perhaps on some local properties that receive heavy pressure or whatnot or differential pressure, I don't think statewide that it's a huge thing for us to worry about given the size of our deer herd. Now, as far as the moles are concerned, the moles have been very active this fall. Soil moisture has been good throughout the fall. We've had no frozen ground yet, at least not around me, and I'm still flattening out mole runways around my backyard every time I go outside.
Yeah.
So they're still active, and until we get freezing at the soil surface, which should occur within the next 3 or 4 days from what I see on the weather forecast, that will then drive the moles deeper in the soil column to stay below the frost line. And that should be the end of mole activity for this year, I hope, because I'm sick and tired of flattening out those runways. But I think for anybody to, other than go out and take the cosmetic action of stomping on them or rolling them out, not the moles, the runways, there's really little else that's justified at this point. Using some of the expensive repellents like mole mat or the other castor oil repellents, or going to the trouble of trapping right now, is probably not worth the effort. They'll be out of sight, out of mind until next spring. And depending on soil moisture, you know, maybe it'll be a good mole year, maybe it won't. So nothing, it is going on, but it's a circumstance of the weather, and really nothing to be too concerned about.
Paul in Crivitz, we turn to you now. Hi, Paul.
Good afternoon.
What can we do for you?
Well, I was just going to give a little input on my deer hunt this year. And I had an extremely good year. I saw more deer this year than I did in the last 4 years put together.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a hit-and-miss operation. Every deer hunter knows that, you know.
Yep.
And I like the 16-day idea. I'm just wondering why you picked them 2 weeks and not the first week.
Not the first 2 weeks in November?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I think there's a couple of things going on there, Paul. First of all, another important point for the non-hunting listeners or even some of the hunters who may be listening is that the distribution of deer on the landscape is far from even and far from uniform, even in local areas. So you had a good hunt. My son and I had a fantastic hunt on a Monday morning up in Juneau County. You know, Larry's group, not so much. so it depends entirely kind of what side of the fence you were on, literally. So I'm glad you had a good hunt. As far as the selection of weeks for this potential two-week season, there seems to be pretty strong sentiment that, as we were just discussing, that the strong tradition in Wisconsin is for the opening day, even though there are many opening days now, realistically, the kind of traditional opening day to be the Saturday before Thanksgiving. And therefore, the strongest support seems to be, if there's a longer season, to start it then and then have it continue the week after Thanksgiving. While there are many gun hunters who would love to be in the woods in early November because of the rut, of course, which would probably lead to a higher harvest and more opportunity to harvest bucks for the gun hunters, that, of course, is traditionally a period when the archery hunters are very keenly interested in being in the woods. And it's... it's quite clear that there's a bit of friction there and turf protection, essentially, and the archery hunters would not be particularly thrilled in a general sense, even though some people are both, of having gun hunting going on during the rut.
There you have it. Thank you very much for calling, Paul. Mike in Coon Valley, on to you. Hello, Mike.
Hi. Just got a couple questions concerning mountain lions presence in Wisconsin. I know it's very small right now, but first question was it historically found in Wisconsin and was eliminated by the early settlers?
Yes.
Okay. So then now what kind of protection is being enforced on them right now? I mean, I have never seen them, but if they're harassing livestock or something, are you allowed to shoot it, or is it a protected?
I believe they're a protected animal, but we're a ways away from, I think, actual problems with the animals. We only have, despite many, many rumors and sightings and alleged photographs and assorted other things over literally as long as Larry and I have been doing this.
Right.
It's only been recently, winter before last, the first documentation, and then last winter the one up in Burnett County with DNA evidence, with blood samples, with photographs. I mean, the one last in Burnett County was clearly photographed in a tree, and the DNR was trying to capture it. So clearly there are some... I don't know what happened to the one in Burnett County, the one that was in southern Wisconsin, ultimately was shot outside Chicago. So some passed through the state. There may very well be some in the state, but it's still quite contentious as to how many there are and where they are. And I think everybody's willing to accept their presence at this point, but they're certainly not numerous. Any kind of an incident, as you describe, that would involve livestock harassment or a safety issue or anything like that would be a really rare, isolated incident right now.
Okay. And last point of question is, why do we even want them back in Wisconsin? Why do we want them?
well, you saved the toughest question for last. Well, I think, first of all, since your first question was, were they a native species, and the answer was yes, then there's an interest, at least within the wildlife and conservation community, to attempt to do what we can to restore native species to the state. So, I mean, that was the impetus behind the return of the elk, behind the concern for at least augmenting what few wolves were left, and for restoring things that were extirpated, like fishers and pine martens and so on. When you start talking about large predators, however, that were largely eliminated by early settlers and residents because of fear for safety or concern over competition over other wildlife resources or livestock or whatnot, then it starts to get a little bit dicey, because the expectation is that the problems that led early settlers to say, hey, let's get these mountain lions out of here, will come back with the lions. And while to a certain extent that might be true, most of those problems, I think the wildlife managers feel they're manageable, and they're doing just that with the wolf situation right now in terms of trying to manage livestock depredations, loss of dogs, hunting dogs and pets and things like that, to the point that eventually when either the wolves or potentially mountain lions or anything else reach a point where those problems are unmanageable, then we start to hear talk about limited hunting opportunity or other controls to keep the to keep a lid on the population, so that we can essentially enjoy and take some satisfaction in the fact that a native species is back on the Wisconsin landscape, but at the same time it's not causing so many problems that there's a hue and cry to get rid of them again.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a peaceful yep. coexistence situation.
And thanks, Mike, for calling. Wes in Sheboygan, we turn to you now. Hello, Wes.
Hello. I had an ongoing problem with raccoons and opossums all through the summer, and I just moved here from a large city, so I don't have a lot of rural Wisconsin experience. But I'm wondering, do they hibernate, and will that kind of go away until next summer?
Well, Wes, in order for me to, A, they don't hibernate, but certainly those animals, especially possums, will simply vanish. They'll disappear and den up and stay out of harm's way during extreme weather. But given a historic January thaw or an unusually nice warm day, they'll be out rummaging around looking for something to eat. So they don't hibernate per se, but they will be scarce during really inclement weather. But to answer the question about your problems, you need to tell me what the problems were. If it was, say, garden problems, for example, then sure, those are gone. If it was a matter of them getting into the house or something else, then that's another matter.
Yeah, they were just trying to break into the house and do some property damage, and tried trapping them, but that didn't work. So I just started putting out food and creating a greater distance to attract them away from the house, and that sort of worked. But I just wondered if that was going to go on and on and on, or if they just, you know.
Well, I'd have to tell you, Wes, that I think the food situation is ill-advised all the way around.
Well, I realized, but I was running, you know, into that, but it just seemed like I was at, it was like, what else can I do?
At your wit's end.
I know. I understand that. And I'll just say two things. First of all, for any animals getting into the house, we're kind of entering the last window of opportunity here for people to make sure that their homes and outbuildings and so forth are animal-proof before winter weather sets in, and it's difficult to do that when roofs are icy and snow-covered and so forth. So the first line of defense against any animals getting into the house or any other building is to make the building animal-proof. And that doesn't necessarily mean a concrete wall around it. It just means, you know, skillfully and meticulously searching for any access points that either exist or could be enlarged. And this is anything from a quarter of an inch that would admit a mouse up to a missing soffit vent or a broken attic window that might admit a raccoon. Raccoons are strong enough to tear away rotten boards or roofing, but if a house or building is structurally secure and there are no obvious access points, then there should not be a problem with anything as large as a raccoon or a possum or even a squirrel getting in. Squirrels are rodents, so they can chew their way in. That's another problem. But raccoons and possums are not. So the first issue is make sure the house is structurally solid, and that problem should go away. And then as far as removing some coons or possums from the area, first thing to realize is that there are a lot of them on the landscape. And trying to live trap and remove them is kind of cutting yourself in for a lifetime hobby. But nevertheless, you should be able, with a good size, secure, heavy-duty live trap, baited with something that coons really like fish-flavored cat food. I'll just come out. The secret bait, marshmallows with a little strawberry jam on them. And the nice thing about using marshmallows is that it doesn't attract cats and skunks and other things you don't want to catch. But with a good bait and decent trap placement and a good trap, if there's a coon around that's really a little too friendly for your liking, it shouldn't be that big a deal to catch it and remove it.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Wes. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Scott, we have an email from Cicely, who I believe contacted us on an earlier program about going deer hunting. So she has some comments. She said, the deer we did see all had antlers. I had a great shot at one buck, but since we saw no antlerless deer, we had to let him go. I can't say I'm a big fan of hurting a buck. I didn't want a trophy. I just wanted some venison. With no private land to go to, we tried a local state park, saw lots of hunters along with hikers, dogs, and bicyclists. Felt like I was intruding on their space, and we saw no deer after opening weekend. I'll certainly try again. I hope I can find a better spot.
Well, I'm glad that Cicely did get out. I had, after the program last month, many listeners had suggestions for spots, and we offered up a couple. And I know where she hunted, and sorry she didn't get a chance at a deer that she could actually shoot. But that particular problem of seeing a buck and not having a buck permit is one of the things that has caused some anxiety over that regulation. But nevertheless, hunters are always optimistic, and their next year's coming up.
And Linda emailed us. She said, I'm so excited. I just saw a pileated woodpecker at my bird feeders. Ran out and got my camera, but he got way too
got
fast.
Away.
Oh, man. She's about 9 miles north of Mauston on 58 in Juneau County. Lots of jack pine and oaks. That's a great sight to see pileated or pileated, as some call it, a woodpecker.
Big woodpecker.
Yeah, big woodpecker. Ken in East Troy, we turn to you. Hi, Ken.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a question about a painted turtle. Mm-hmm. A little over a week ago, I live on a river, and the painted turtle came out on the lawn and about 4 days in a row. And it wasn't sunny out, and I was just wondering, is this unusual this late in the year?
It is a little unusual this late in the year. Of course, when these animals, these cold-blooded animals, begin to slow down as it gets chilly, and by now, without any sun, when they should give them a basking opportunity, I don't know what to say about that, Ken. Yes, it's unusual, but not unheard of. Painted turtles are active particularly early in the spring and particularly late in the fall. I picked one up... I don't know, it wasn't too many years ago from a phone call from someone who said, hey, there's a turtle in my window well. And as I recall, it was either December 4th or December 12th, yeah. And it was near zero, and the turtle was in a window well. So it does happen, but it's unusual. Was this a good-sized turtle, not a hatchling?
No, I'd say he's about 6 inches.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, why it was out there and repeatedly, I'm not sure, unless it was hoping it was a little warmer out there than it was in the water. But it is getting late, and, of course, those animals, the frogs, turtles, and those kinds of things will have long disappeared for the winter here shortly.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much. Kevin in Wyawega, we are on to you now. Hi, Kevin.
Good afternoon. How are you today?
Great. Thanks for calling.
All right. I want to make sure you encourage Wes not to keep feeding those raccoons and possums by his house, because they will be at his kitchen table with a knife and fork in her hand if he keeps that up.
That's right.
Okay, we're going to get to deer hunting right away and make it brief. I hunt in Unit 2 and Unit 3 in Bayfield County, land that's been in our hunting gang. We have 24 people in our gang. We do not sit in heated box stands like 80% of the other people in the state. We do drives. I average 4.8 miles a day. I'm not bragging. I'm trying to get to a point.
Okay.
We went through swamps, ravines, drives that have been in our family and our hunting gang for anywhere from 50 to 75 years. And on two of the days that we did drives, we physically saw more timber wolves than deer. This is in Bayfield County on the shoreline of Lake Superior, far, far from humanity. But the point I'm trying to get at, yeah, there's a ton of coyotes, too. But, you know, coyotes, you can shoot them basically 10 months out of the year if you wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
The timber wolf population in the state, and I don't want to get on a timber wolf rant, and I will not do it. It's just ungodly. And the biggest problem we saw, not only we were down, we shoot a huge number of deer. I'm not going to lie to you. We shot over 20 deer, only $6, legally shot deer. But the problem is there's no fawns, absolutely zero fawns. We saw one fawn in 9 days, and we're not sitting in stands sitting on private land. We do federal property, paper mill property, private property in our group. We saw one fawn all season. That is a bad, bad sign for the state of Wisconsin's deer herd.
Well,
I was in Unit 9, by the way, in Bayfield County.
Yeah, Larry wasn't very far south of you. As for the wolf situation, I realize that that's a concern for many northern residents, but again, that one seems to be a manageable concern. The lack of fawns in many northern units, particularly a little further east of you in the northeastern units, was well recognized prior to the season, largely a result of lousy fawn recruitment after the last couple of winters, which have been more traditional Wisconsin winters than we've had in a long time. Fawn recruitment was down, and as a result, regulations, especially in the Northeast, were set such that there were very few, if any, antlerless permits available for some of those management units. Now, as I look at the various DNR-produced maps here prior to the season, units 2 and 3, one was listed at a near goal, that was 3, and unit 2, in yellow on this colored map that a lot of people were using, was listed at 20 to 40% above goal. So still reasonable deer numbers in that area, but it was widely recognized that fawn recruitment was down, and there were and what you saw obviously bears that out, sure. And as a result, I think a lot of the managers in the North Country, at least, are talking about some continued restrictions and rebuilding to try and get the herd back up to the management goal, where in fact it's below the management goal. In other units where either a combination of winter weather or hunting has actually gotten the deer down closer to goal, you know, that in fact is what we've been trying to do for a long time. So rather than perhaps look at that as a calamity or failure, in fact, it's quite possible to put on a smiley face here and say, holy cow, in some parts of the state, we're actually back where we wanted to be and probably should be for the future. And that's why I said early on in the program that for some places in the state, what we're seeing now is actually, I think, a vision of the future. So,
how many wolves or how many deer will a wolf take in the course of a year? It's about one a week or something like that?
I think in terms of nutritional requirements, most of the literature or popular accounts I've seen said that an individual wolf needs over the course of a year the food value of perhaps 17 to 20, 18, 19, 20 deer. Call it 20 on the round side.
Every 2 weeks or something.
So it's 20 deer per wolf, and the wolf population estimate is around 650. So, you know, if they ate nothing but deer, which is not the case, and some of the deer that they eat are carrion, roadkill, lost, wounded deer, and so forth, it's still a relatively small number compared to, say, deer vehicle collisions or certainly hunting mortality. But having said that, there are areas, as Kevin just described, where there are enough active wolf packs to have some local impact, and that's why some hunters in local areas are concerned about it.
Mm-hmm. My brother saw 4 wolves one day as well.
Really?
Bayfield County, yeah. So, David in Ironwood, Michigan, we turn to you now.
Wolves again. My main concern is cities, they need to take measures to keep deer out of the town because before the wolves came back, no big deal. But now that the wolves are back, if you're letting deer and other, their, you know, predator animals will follow the deer into town eventually. And that's bad news, what I call it. So, you know, just a heads up that, hey, keep them. And wolves, they do have a benefit. I mean, when wolves came back to Yellowstone, the fishing improved because the trees had a chance to grow by the streams where before they were ate by the elk and stuff. So,
all right.
Well, a good case in point that all things are linked ecologically, but I think the concern over deer in urban areas has been a longstanding issue in many urban centers across the northern tier of states in the United States and right here in Wisconsin. And there are Herculean efforts made to keep deer out of a number of city parks and places like the Arboretum here in Madison and other such areas. But that generally is predicated on attempting to prevent ecological damage and nearby deer collisions with vehicles and so forth. I don't think there's a great deal of concern that animals that are as anxious about people and urbanization as wolves will need to come into the city to find food, given the deer herd and other food resources they have outside urban areas.
Okay.
But in any event, good point.
Yep. Thanks, David. And Sally in Wayland, Minnesota, we're on to you now. Hi, Sally.
Hey, Larry. Hey, Wes. I was out playing in my pond yesterday, and I scooped up some tadpoles that are like, they're just starting to turn into frogs. They're mm-hmm. just sprouting little tiny back legs. And I thought, this will be interesting. I'll take them inside and I'll watch them turn into frogs. I have an aquarium set up actually next to my bed so I can sit and watch them while I fall asleep. But right now it's easy to feed them because they eat algae. So I've got algae growing in there. Tadpoles are easy to feed. But when they turn into frogs, they're meat eaters and they like live meat.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have any suggestions on what I can do to be sure that I have a source of food for them that they'll accept?
Well, first of all, do you know what kind of frogs you're dealing with yet?
There's several different kinds. I know that I've had peepers out there. I've had bullfrogs. I've had leopard frogs. I've had all kinds of different frogs. And I know the tadpoles, there are many different sizes, many different colors, so it's just
okay.
an assortment.
Well, interesting. And some frogs, especially the larger species in Wisconsin, overwinter 1 year as tadpoles before they metamorphose and become frogs the next summer. So that's fairly normal. So especially green frogs and bullfrogs, that's pretty standard for them to overwinter for a year. Most of the others should have emerged by now, the tree frogs and peepers and so forth. So it'll be interesting to see what you come up with. If you do come up with a mixed bag, or even come up with a mixed bag that's nothing more than one bullfrog and a few green frogs, you won't have to worry much about feeding them because you're only going to end up with one big bullfrog. That will eat anything else that happens to be in there that moves. But assuming things are a little more mellow than that, and maybe you've got a handful of green frogs that develop, your best source of food is going to be a good-sized pet store, which, because of the frequency of people keeping various reptiles and amphibians now, most pet stores have a supply of live crickets on hand at all times, and crickets work well. Most bait shops will have a supply of assorted live bait. Worms work fine. When I raised green frogs, they just loved angleworms, and that was easy enough to keep them going through the winter on live worms. And depending on where you are and if the ground hasn't frozen yet, with good soil moisture, get yourself some worm bedding at the local sporting goods store and collect a supply of worms right now before it's too cold, digging around in a compost pile or something, and you'll have enough food for them for the winter without having to buy it.
I can do that.
All right.
There you go.
Good luck. Thanks, Sally. And lots of callers on them. By the way, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or shoot us an email at talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Claire in Delafield is up next. Claire, hello to you.
Good morning.
Morning.
How are you gentlemen this morning?
We're good.
Fine.
Good. Enjoying the show, and I thought I'd call in with a question or two. We've started to sight bald eagles in the area around Pewaukee Lake and Lake Nagawicca. And one of them had been feeding in the field across the road from us and was being bombarded by a red-tailed hawk, dumb hawk. But anyway, and I'm just wondering if, their territory is expanding into this area or if, this is a fluke that we're starting to see them and they're on their way elsewhere.
Well, it could be some of both. Certainly, eagle populations have been doing very well, and as a result, they have been moving further south than previously. Not necessarily historically, but certainly in the last 20 or 30 years. Few eagles in southern Wisconsin, but they are now nesting regularly along the Wisconsin River and at other points in southern and central Wisconsin. So you may just be seeing the start of a nesting pair or two in that area. On the other hand,
it's thrilling to see them.
Oh, they're spectacular.
Right.
So
phenomenal.
That's pretty neat. But by the same token, this time of year, as things freeze up in the north and eagles move out, a lot of them just move down to southern Wisconsin and take up residence along either the lower Wisconsin or other areas near a dam or some feature that keeps water open and provides them with a fairly steady source of fish. So some may be transients, some may be here for the winter only, and if you're starting to see them during the nesting season or warmer season, it may be the start of a nesting effort.
Mm. Now that's great. We welcome them. It's just... It's great to see. Oh, they're wonderful to see, and they cause all sorts of traffic jams on the roadways.
Thanks, Claire. Thank you very much for your call. Craig and Bloomer, we're on to you now. Hi, Craig.
Hi. I had a question. I had my woods logged off about a year ago last fall, and I have a good section of oaks on it, but I had a bunch of birch and popple that were all about 25, 30 years old that needed to be harvested. And my question is, I didn't get a lot of sapling production out of the birch and popple. I think it was because of the drought last year up in around Bloomer area. And my question is that for deer habitat, should I be looking at planting some pine trees and some shrubs like nine bark and so forth, or am I really just better off just waiting to see if the birch and popple come back?
Well, I think before you spend the time, money, and effort to do any planting, I'd give it a little more time to see what you get for regeneration from your popple in particular. If that starts to come back, those huge root systems that support those trees should still be okay, even with the drought, hopefully. And after you've had it logged off, give it another year, especially next spring if there's any moisture. You should start to see some sprouts from the stumps and some sprouts from the surrounding root system. And if that happens, you probably won't need to worry about much planting.
Oh.
So I'd give it a little more time.
All right. And Johnson in Lake Tomahawk, it's your turn next. Hello.
This is Jonathan. Great show. First of all, I'd like to bring up the question. I spent 26 years in the military, so grew up in Wisconsin, northern Wisconsin, went away in 81, and recently came back. And, you know, baiting's allowed. And baiting was never allowed for deer. And what I find is people that I run into really don't know how to deer hunt, but they know how to bait.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that Marathon County outlawed baiting. And then, you know, basically it's going further north. My concern is the agricultural impact of baiting and then banning baiting. And I just want to get your guests' thoughts on baiting. And, you know, eventually are we just going to get smart and ban it and become true deer hunters?
Well, Jonathan, the to bait or not to bait debate is is a longstanding one, and there are a couple of factors involved. Fairly recently, the pendulum seemed to be swinging more toward, oh, it's finally time to get rid of baiting, but there's been no legislative or other initiative on that front recently. There are many folks who are very supportive of baiting. There are many folks who are very much opposed to baiting for a variety of the reasons that you mentioned, as well as others. There are some pretty good biological reasons why it may not be a good idea and may be detrimental, but that doesn't necessarily carry the day when it comes to convincing people to cease and desist in terms of its effects on movement patterns of deer, on their nutrition, a variety of other things, but and, as well as the disease issue. But the kicker is, and the reason some of the baiting bans are working their way north, is that baiting is in fact banned in any areas where chronic wasting disease has been identified, and I think in some adjoining counties. And that's where we've seen it banned, and may, I hope we don't see it extended that way, because that would mean we're finding more widespread chronic wasting disease, which would be bad news. So that's what's going on in regard to the disease situation. I'm not sure where to tell you to go.
A number of years in Alaska, 12 years, great state. And I'm an avid hunter, obviously. And Don Young, a biologist, not the congressman, in Fairbanks, Alaska, kind of discovered that the major killer of calf moose, and I'm equating that to fallen whitetails, was black bear. Mm-hmm. And he discovered that black bear actually stalked, and well, not stalked, but hung around heavily burdened, pregnant, about to give birth, cow moose. Now, in this past spring and early summer, I saw 36 black bears,
mm-hmm.
you know, driving between Rhinelander and Antigo. 36, the most I've ever seen. You know, and in a wooded environment, that's a lot.
Did you see that many deer?
I did not.
Okay.
I did not see. Well, you know, I don't know.
Okay.
I count the deer. I see deer all the time. But on my brother's land near Gleason, he owns 240 acres,
mm-hmm.
and we've become trail camera junkies.
Mm-hmm.
And we had three trail cameras. We saw one doe with a fawn. One.
Mm-hmm.
One fawn this year, and we set them up in July and religiously check them, you know, at least every week. And we saw no fawns during the hunting season.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that, and obviously the DNR screwed up when they, and I'm not, you know, nobody's perfect, but the underestimating the bear population.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a little crazy to have to wait 10 years to get a black bear permit.
Well, let's back up for a second. First okay. of all, bears are one of the uncertainties as far as the deer situation right now. The primary time when bears are a factor is during fawning, and bears certainly do eat deer fawns. And there are a lot more bears on the landscape than we thought there were. But the notion of the DNR screwing up on that was a lack of information. And in fact, the DNR funded and supported the study that ultimately pinned down the number of bears mm-hmm. through the Bacon tetracycline study that determined that there were probably more than 30,000 bears, where we previously thought there were maybe 14,000 or 15,000. So the fact that we now have a better handle on the bear population is just an example of management getting better and better for many of these species. And in response to that information that there were many more bears, the number of permits was dramatically increased very quickly and maybe further increased. And by the way, we need to mention that next week is the deadline for some of these permit applications.
Yes,
Larry,
we'll do that,
remind
right.
me.
We'll do that.
But certainly back to your original point that bears are a predator on calf moose in Alaska. They're a predator on fawn deer here in Wisconsin too. But their impact is not very well known. It's out there. If you do the math and think about 30,000 some bears and 650 wolves, you know, I'd have to say, wow, you know, maybe bears are more of an issue here than the wolves are. I don't know.
Keith
maybe.
And Wanna Key
so
emailed us with that comment.
There are lots of things out there going on that are all being brought to bear on the deer herd right now. Winter weather, bears, moose, coyote, not moose, bears, wolves, coyotes, hunters, a whole host of things, and as a result,
cars, and
chronic wasting disease and so forth. So there are a whole host of things now putting pressure on the deer herd, and we see a lower deer herd that's now reflected in a lower harvest. So the real question now is, okay, is this the way it's going to be, or are steps going to be taken to move in one direction or another? That's really, this is all post facto information now.
Yeah,
the herd's down. Everybody, a lot of hunters suggested that early on. Everybody recognizes that now, and we have the evidence in the reduced harvest to suggest that that was true. So now what happens? We'll find out.
Stay tuned. All right. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest today as we talk about the world of wildlife here in the state. Pleased to have you with us, and call in with your questions at 800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. We have some applications due. I know spring turkey applications are due on December 10th. I don't have mine in yet. I've got to get that in.
Me too, and bear applications.
Bear
so
applications.
The last big permit deadline of the year is December 10th. So for would-be turkey hunters for next spring and would-be bear hunters, next week's an important deadline to not miss, although at least in the case of turkeys, with some surplus tags available for a spring sale, people have had a second chance over the last couple of years. But nevertheless, if you're thinking bears or turkeys for 2010, get on the stick and get your applications in.
You know, trail cameras have come up two or three times here in the course of the program today, and that's as we think about holiday gifts for outdoor people, not only for hunters, but for anyone kind of interested in what's going on in the outdoors. Trail cameras would make one nice gift.
There are many terrific gift ideas related to wildlife in the outdoors, and this is obviously a great time of year to talk about it. Trail cameras were number one on my hit list here to recommend. They're, as many listeners have said or stated, there's a lot of them out on the landscape, and we get, well, I'll use an expression, but there's hardly a day that goes by that I don't get two or three emails with picture attachments, many of which come from trail cameras, you know, saying, hey, look, either look what I saw or what the heck is this thing?
Yeah.
And, you know, in years gone by on the program, Larry, we'd get calls and say, gee, I saw something that was bigger than a bread box and it was brown and yeah. I couldn't see its tail. And often we were unable to help them. But with the pictures coming in, pictures don't lie.
Yeah.
Sometimes the picture takers stretch the truth a little bit as to where it was or whatnot. But nevertheless, the pictures don't lie and we're usually able to help people. And there's a wide range of cameras available, from relatively inexpensive to fairly expensive. As with regular cameras, I think you get what you pay for, but certainly going to digital, trying to find one that does not have a flash, which tips off,
yeah,
you know, passersby and other things. The stealthier, the better. The more secure, the better, and the easier to use, the better. And if that means higher price, well, then it's probably worth the investment. But people find and see things that they had
no
clue were on their property, and that makes them kind of a neat thing.
And plenty of other things, too. There are some things out there for kids to get them into the outdoors, which I think is cool, too.
Well, I sure hope so. I was going to talk about this for a minute if given the opportunity, so I guess I'll take it. This morning on the, you know, one of my concerns has always been this notion of nature deficit disorder that came from the book Last Child in the Woods.
Yeah.
And the concern that kids don't get outdoors much anymore, that they're tied to electronics, that they're tied to the indoors, and that therefore they know very little about natural history or the ability to identify even the most obvious birds or plants. And it, at least in my thinking, and I think a lot of other people who are interested in outdoor education, this does not bode well for the future. We've got a generation coming along that has been distanced from outdoor, natural history, natural resources issues, and when it comes to them voting or participating in activities like hunting or other things, it just makes things a whole lot more difficult. And then on the news this morning, I see a feature about gym classes using Wii's, electronic games, to get the kids to play electronic tennis or basketball, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, and they're in a gym. What happened to the real basketball? And so this is the kind of thing. Now, the gym teachers involved or the phys ed teachers made a case that this is what the kids are interested in, so it at least gets them somewhat active. But it's the same kind of problem with outdoor stuff. So if you can do anything this holiday season or at any other time to get the kids, the grandkids, the neighbors' kids, the Boy Scouts, Cub Scouts, 4-H kids, or whatever else, out in your backyard or out on your land and show them something, like the frogs that our caller was developing in their house, or identify some trees, or just show them the different kinds of Christmas trees and the fact that some of them are actually real. They're not all plastic. Then that's a real step in the right direction. But for kids, you know, lots of good books and games, lots of good things like an insect net and a little plastic habitat to just catch some bugs and look at them. Binoculars, their first pair of binoculars to go out and look around. Kids' versions of popular field guides so that they can identify some of the things they're seeing. A bird feeder to put outside their bedroom window or whatnot. Whatever you can think of to try and get them interested in something going on away from the television or the computer would be a very good thing.
Very good thing. Well, let's take another call. Sasha in Madison's been waiting a while, so we go to you now, Sasha. Thanks
Hi.
For calling.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking my call. I had a question about albino deer. I had some friends that were lucky enough to see an 8-point albino buck.
Mm-hmm.
During their hunting this past weekend. And it just got me thinking, how many of these animals exist and just how lucky were my friends to actually get a glimpse, not just one, but several glimpses of this animal.
Where were they hunting, by the way?
They were over by Leland, Wisconsin.
Leland. What county?
Now you're going to test me. it's going to be around like Devil's Lake, just north of there.
Okay.
So
all right. Okay. Well, then that's very unusual because okay. the stronghold for albino deer and sightings and so forth is a little more north, particularly around Boulder Junction in northeastern yeah. Wisconsin, where it's still an unusual experience, but there seem to be a few more of them up there. They are protected in the state, so where they occur, they're given some protection. It's a very rare circumstance. I've spent many years in the woods in Wisconsin and many years as a hunter, and so has Larry. And I would guess if you polled our listeners, there are darn few people who can lay claim to have seen an albino deer in the wild. It's a
yeah,
very unusual circumstance, and as you move down here into southern Wisconsin, it's even more unusual. And if it's something that piques your interest, there's a local photographer and naturalist in the Boulder Junction area by the name of Jeff Richter, who has a beautiful book on albino deer out. I'm trying
beautiful
to remember the name of it. It's Ghosts of the Forest. I can't remember the name of the book, but nevertheless, beautiful photography and an interesting account of the deer and why and where they occur. So
type his name in a search engine and it'll come up.
Okay,
Jeff Richter.
Okay. Right. Okay, thanks. Yeah.
Yep.
So much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. And Tammy and Marshall, we are on to you now. Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Larry and Scott. Two quick comments. I'm very positively interested in wolves being reintroduced in Wisconsin. I know I'm in Dane County, so I don't have to worry about them taking my dogs, but it's a thrill to see them when you get to see them out in the wild. We got to see our first one out in Yellowstone this year, so we see them in captivity up in Ely at the International Wolf Center in Minnesota every year, but it was a thrill to see one in the wild. Second comment is I'm seeing eagles out here in Marshall, and that's a thrill, too.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful to see these animals coming back. My question, Scott, is when I walk on public hunting grounds with my dogs, if I pull into the parking lot and see other vehicles there, I go away. Even though I've got Blaze orange on and the dogs have orange collars on, I'm just curious about etiquette, if I should be walking them despite someone else being there, whether they're walking their dogs or, frankly, you know, I assume they're hunters.
On a public hunting ground, on property that has been purchased presumably with hunter-generated dollars or dollars from sportsmen's excise taxes or whatnot, the impetus for that land was to provide hunting opportunity, but certainly that's for a fairly narrow window during the year, and people can use it for a variety of purposes much of the year or even when hunting is occurring. However, there is a couple issues. One is that, you know, you walking your dog might disturb a deer hunter, for example. On the other hand, some hunters are very happy to see somebody else come into an area thinking they may kick up a deer, and all of a sudden the deer runs by them and they have a chance to shoot it. For my purposes, with my dogs on a public hunting ground, for example, last week, it was beautiful weather most of the week, and my son was here, so we said, oh, let's take the dogs down to the public hunting ground and look for a pheasant. And we got down there with the dogs, and there were deer hunters all over. That made me a little squeamish, but I've been around guns enough that it didn't stop us from going out with the dogs and looking for a pheasant. But nevertheless, it is a concern for some folks. And now that much of southern Wisconsin allows the use during the deer season of rifles as opposed to shotguns, so you have guns that potentially carry a projectile a lot further, I guess I would just recommend that at least during the deer season, even with Blaze Orange, while I certainly wouldn't be concerned about being in the woods on my own land or neighbor's land or whatever else, being on a public hunting ground might be pressing the issue a little bit.
And I actually wonder, aren't there like squirrels and there's all kinds of hunting seasons basically throughout the winter?
Sure. There are hunting seasons that run into, I think, rabbit season runs until the end of February. Yeah. But for the most part, there are very few people out doing that. And yeah, some of these public hunting grounds are very large areas. And when there's snow, you know, you can clearly see where someone's gone. So if you wanted to be out hiking or enjoying the benefits of that public land, no problem.
No problem. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Tammy. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, as our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. And lots of emails, lots of calls. And Scott, I know we talked about gifts, and poinsettias this time of year are a nice gift, that sort of thing. And I know that here on campus, on the UW-Madison campus, there's a poinsettia sale and a tree sale, things for people to buy.
Yes, and it's my own department, so hey, why not give them a little publicity? The Forestry Club is holding their 33rd annual Christmas tree sale starting on December 4th. Today's the second. So the 4th to the 6th, I think it's Friday through Sunday in the UW Stock Pavilion right down at our end of campus. They've got beautiful trees. The Hort Club is selling poinsettias. Hey, it goes toward ultimately training future conservationists. So good place to get a tree at the Stock Pavilion this weekend.
And they're really nice trees, too. Dan says, my brother-in-law insists the DNR does not have accurate data collection measures for establishing the deer population. What techniques are used, and what's the confidence level?
The age-old question about how we figure out how many deer there are. In the Reader's Digest version of the whole thing, a mathematical model called the Sex, Age, Kill, or SAK formula, and involves a variety of data inputs from deer registration, from deer observations, and from some calculations from the harvest. And although, because it's a fairly complicated calculation, there's a lot of suspicion and anxiety over it, it's probably the best there is in the country. And with several recent independent audits by scientists that the DNR has brought in at the request of the Conservation Congress and others, the method has been vindicated. They're working on fine-tuning it. It has become more complicated in recent years because the regulations have been so highly variable. But it does the job. And when they've attempted to validate it with helicopter surveys and so forth, things have usually been pretty close. But it's not exact by any means. And there are calculations for a whole slew of deer management units in the state. So, you know, folks, bear with us here. It's not an exact science, but it's as good as it gets here in Wisconsin. And the real issue, I think, over the next few months will be what the deer season is going to look like in 2010 and some agreement on how many deer we have and which way the herd is going. And that's the big issue.
That's the big issue. All right. Joan emailed us and wonders how deep moles dig. She's thinking about putting an underground fence around her property to keep them out. How deep would a fence have to go?
It would have to go deep, especially during the winter when these animals go down below the frost line. So in a year when there's not much snow and deep frost, those animals could be down 2 or 3 feet or even a little more. So I think unless it's a very small property, the expense of trenching in a fence that's going to be fairly durable underground is,
yeah.
I can't even begin to think about that. It sounds just too expensive and labor intensive, and it would have to be deep enough that, I just think that's a real chore.
Dennis in Richland County, your turn. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I'm up in rural northeast Richland County, and a neighbor and I have both seen an animal that we want to say, what the heck is this thing? It's a cat-like, black cat-like animal, and it's big. We'd guess 50 to 60 pounds, something like that. And it moves like a cat moves. It's just very, we see feral cats out here mm-hmm. moving, and they prowl in a particular way. But this thing's too big to be
kind of a
though.
Tail.
Long
bushy tail?
My sighting said long bushy tail. The other guy said he thought it was more. Excuse me. He said black panther. Are there black panthers out here? So
no, but if it has a long tail like that, and when you say it moves like a cat, when you see one moving, it kind of lopes along a little bit. If it's moving, kind of a humpy kind of movement.
The one I saw wasn't.
Was he, going slow.
He was moving not very fast, and his back was just as horizontal and smooth as could be.
But very dark colored in any event.
Yeah,
well,
very,
I think there have been there have been several accounts recently, one in Columbia County and one a couple of years ago down near Dodgeville, of fishers moving further south. And in that kind of rugged, wooded country over there in Richland County, from what you describe, I think the most likely explanation is a fisher.
Oh, okay.
So Google a fisher on the internet, and you'll see lots of pictures, or look it up in a field guide, or see if you can find some video. And I'd be surprised if you don't say, aha, a fisher, and go from there.
And
okay?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Russell in Menominee County, I believe.
Pardon me?
Yes, go ahead, Russell.
Oh, hi. I'm in Menominee Falls.
Menominee Falls, sorry.
Yeah, near Milwaukee. And I hadn't been able to listen to the whole show, so I don't know if this question had been addressed previously, but my question was concerning CWD testing.
Uh-huh.
In previous years, I say that because I haven't had a successful hunt until this year, going a few years back. I had been able to take the deer to the ranger station where they would drill into the skull and take a small tissue sample for CWD mm-hmm. testing. This year, however, when I went to the testing at the ranger station wasn't available, so I went to the other places where you'd register your deer,
mm-hmm.
and they actually wanted to take the whole head of the deer for the testing, and I guess I was curious what was the need for that. I know that, as a hunter, especially if you're not on private land, it makes for a long day, and even my question was, no, I didn't get a big buck where I wanted the head for caping for a trophy or something of that nature, but I wondered, that seems like an invasive process. Fortunately for me, the deer that I had taken in was a nubby buck, a buck fawn, and they said that under the 2 years of age, the disease doesn't become prevalent if it would even have the disease at the time. But I'm wondering why they would have to do that.
Well, let me make a couple general comments about the testing, Russell, that I think will answer your question. First of all, early on in the CWD testing, the standard was to lop the head off, and the head went into the processing center in Black Earth, and ultimately the brain stem tissue sample was taken from the head. They've become much better at it. They have lots of people who are pretty good at taking the samples, and the sample can be extracted now without necessarily taking the whole head. So that makes things a little easier for all concerned. Where the testing, and you're right, too, with a nubbin buck or any young deer, they weren't even testing fawns. Right. Even in the center of the CWD area where I registered a deer in Barneveld early on in the season, they said, oh, this is a young one. Unless you really want it tested, we don't want to bother with it. It's an expensive, time-consuming process. So I wasn't bothered by that at all. So you're right on both counts there. And as far as where they're testing and where they're not, again, it is an expensive proposition and requires a lot of effort. So the testing has been relegated to the focal points in southern Wisconsin, in southwest, southeast, and also some selected area of the state outstate where they're attempting to kind of rotate the testing around to make sure the rest of the state remains CWD free. So it depends entirely on where your animal was taken and what happened from there.
And thank you very much for your call. Gloria in Grafton, we turn to you now. Hi, Gloria.
Well, hi, guys. How are you doing?
Good.
Great.
Good. Listen, I am just perplexed by something, and maybe we can, you know, get an answer here. I live in the town of Grafton on the Milwaukee River, lived here about 29 years, and every single year since the first year, like clockwork, in October, my little friends, the Juncos, have appeared, and they leave again, you know, late in the spring. Not one this year.
Well, be patient. The Juncos will likely appear. Realize that virtually all of Wisconsin, I mean, here we are into early December, and I think other than some lake effect snow up in the very far north, Wisconsin is snow-free.
Right.
And up until the end of the week last week, it was darn near as warm in Rhinelander as it was here in southern Wisconsin. So I suspect that the movement of Juncos, I still had robins in my yard this weekend.
Yeah.
So I think this is just a function of the way the season is going along. It's supposed to get, well, it's already cooled off here, and it's supposed to be pretty chilly here for the rest of the week. So be patient. I predict you'll see your Juncos here within a week or two.
And thanks for calling. Don in Germantown, on to you.
Hi, gentlemen. Great show. Love the whole show that you guys are having. I have a question about sandhill cranes. Last week I was watching a flock. Looks like they were migrating south. They were pretty high up,
a dozen and a half,
somewhere in that area. But what they were doing, and the wind was kind of crisp. I wouldn't say it was real heavy wind, but they were flying into the wind, and they would go maybe 100 yards, and the whole flock would loop back with the wind.
Mm-hmm.
They were doing complete loops. Is that typical of cranes, or
for cranes and for hawks and some other birds that are perhaps not migrating as far as some others, it's not necessarily a frantic, got to get there tomorrow kind of migration. They proceed fairly slowly and work along following air wind currents and thermals and so forth. And what's happening on the ground, what you feel for wind, may be an entirely different situation, you know, a few hundred or a few thousand feet up. But it is fairly typical for them to just kind of meander along, and they'll circle, especially if you see what's called a kettle or a large group of hawks migrating. They're circling along, and they're getting those
updrafts.
Yeah, they don't look like they're making any progress, but as you watch them over time, the whole mess has slowly drifted off to the south, and eventually they get where they want to go.
Yeah.
Huh. It just seemed very unusual because it happened, I would say, until I lost sight of them.
Yeah.
Yep. That's what they do.
And there you have it. Thank you, Don, for calling. We have Dean emailing us. I'm sorry, Susan emailing us. Has a coworker with an outdoor cat. Lately, they've seen coyotes in the area. Their cat likes to hang out. Any way to discourage coyotes? Keep the cat indoors.
Well, that would be the first thing that comes to mind. I mean, if there are coyotes, there are coyotes in every area. Most people don't realize it, but there are a lot of coyotes around. Coyotes will take cats. The only foolproof thing to protect the cat is to keep the cat indoors. The notion that coyotes would be rousted from an entire area or neighborhood just is not going to happen. Not going to happen. So while around a home, you can, you know, do what you can with fencing or disturbance if you see the animals or what have you. I think the only safe thing there, the only foolproof thing, is to keep the cat indoors.
Tom has a hot tub on the deck, and we're considering putting some insulation in behind the exterior wood framing to better hold heat and reduce heating needs and costs. There's an access point through a side door to the operating controls. However, I'm wondering whether I would create two great nesting opportunities for mice. Can't put mice poison around because of other animals.
Well, that kind of a situation outside would be an invitation to white-footed mice or whatnot as harborage. But I think as the insulation's going in, it would be possible to incorporate some little cellophane place packs of rodenticide in with the insulation, or some little mesh bags of moth ice or moth crystals, naphthalene, all of which would the moth crystals would discourage the mice from entering in the first place because they don't like the smell. And if they got in, the mice are capable of chewing into the little pesticide or rodenticide bag, whereas other animals, birds or pets or whatever, would not have access to it because it's back in amongst the insulation. And that might be something that would have to be rejuvenated periodically or at least every year. But I think it would allow the insulation that he wants without having to worry about the mice.
Dave in Oconomowoc takes exception with the caller hunting in Bayfield County who claimed 80% hunt from heated box stands. He says, I seriously doubt it's more than 2%. Every hunter I know hikes out to the woods, sits on a stump. His misperception is based on what he sees along the interstate.
Well, we caught that too, Larry, and we're discussing it, and I think there was a little hyperbole there. But, yes, yeah, certainly while there are some fantastic-looking heated, it's almost like little mini houses to sit in, that is very atypical. And, again, everybody I know, everybody I see in the woods is out meandering around looking for a log or a stump to sit on. So,
okay, and we've got, Gary Engberg in Mazo up next. Gary, hello.
Hey, Larry, how you doing?
Great.
I worked with the DNR registering and aging deer during the season in Sauk County, and our numbers up here, just some passing comments, our numbers up here were probably only down less than 5%. A lot of the complaints from people you hear, but I had people, I have a friend with me, he hunted Baraboo Bluff area up near the Nature Conservancy land, hunted hard 8 hours a day for 5 days without seeing a deer.
Mm.
Our overall numbers, though, in Sauk County were less than 5% down from last year. And another comment, during the early seasons, I've never seen so many big, big bucks registered. And I wanted to know if that was maybe because of the earn a buck.
Oh, certainly.
Regulations, because during the early rut, the end of October, beginning of November, a lot of tremendous deer, 160s, 170s, 180s.
Well, I've hunted in what now is the CWD area since 1972 on the same farm, and I think most hunters recognize that in those years, if you saw any antlers at all, you were lucky. Most of them were yearling, little tiny antlers and so forth, and with the onset of earn a buck regulations and chronic wasting disease management with an emphasis moving toward antlerless deer and a trend among hunters to let the smaller bucks go anyway, simply because they realize that a 2.5-year-old animal in farm country is a beautiful animal, yeah, a trophy animal. There were a lot of forces that came together to create a much higher proportion of antlered deer on the landscape, and within the antlered deer, older antlered deer. So 4.5, even 5.5-year-old bucks are starting to turn up.
And it seemed that there was a lot of 4- and 5-year-old bucks where they really have reached their maturity.
Well, that was almost unheard of years ago. And what concerns me a little bit, realizing that we've been desperately trying to reduce the herd in the CWD area, is that, at least in my experience this year, we saw a fair number of deer. They were virtually all bucks. antlerless deer were mighty scarce. And eventually, right now, it's great as far as large bucks are concerned. Whether those animals are eventually removed from the population and the whole thing becomes scarce, the future will tell. But for right now, you're right. There are some beautiful animals out there. And the harvest, by the way, in terms of people who want to see how it varied across the state, there was a very nice map in the State Journal this morning that showed where the harvest was down 40%, 30%, 20%, and so forth. And you're right, in the area we're talking about west of Madison here, that was the lowest reduction at less than, I think it was 15% or something like that. But the interesting thing was that there was not a county in the entire state where the harvest went up. So it was down pretty uniformly. It was down uniformly, but in terms of the percentages, it ranged from, as you can see in that map. So anybody could access that.
A couple other quick questions is, Leland is in Sauk County where that albino deer was seen.
Okay.
So that was just west of us. And as far as your cameras, it's tough to beat a cutty back. There may be one of the pricier ones, but all the experiences I've had, Cutty Back makes by far the best trail cam.
Well, if I'd been pressed to mention a brand, which we don't usually do in the program, it might very well. It might very well have been that one.
They do take very sharp pictures.
Yes.
Thanks, guys. Great show.
All right. Thanks, Gary, for calling. Patty emailed us on Sunday morning, the largest coyote I've ever seen followed my dog. It was, and her dog is 26 and a half inches at the shoulders of Vizsla, right to the back door. The coyote was as tall as the Vizsla. It looked as if he weighed as much as the dog. Should I be concerned about this animal? I wonder if that was a coyote.
It sounds like an awfully big coyote, and when you start to get into that size range, I'd be thinking maybe it was a wolf and not a coyote at all, in which case, yes, maybe she ought to. I think she was asked further in the email, should she report that to the DNR office? And I'd say, yeah, it'd be a good idea to call the Park Falls office and just explain that experience and see what they have to say.
And we have a photo taken in the Holy Hill area last year. Looks like an animal, maybe a squirrel, slid down a steep hill, a snow picture. What do you think, Scott? Animals do this.
It was pretty hard to tell from that picture, Larry, but usually when you see slide marks in the snow that are going down a slope, that's typical behavior for an otter moving across the countryside, yeah, Tobogganing down a slope. I can't tell from that picture, but that's certainly a possibility.
And my husband and I traveled to Yellowstone last fall, saw elk, wolves, moose, coyotes. Is there somewhere in Wisconsin to view these animals in the wild where they've been seen pretty frequently as they are in Yellowstone?
The answer is no. First of all, elk are relegated to the semi-experimental reintroduction up near Clam Lake, but there are major efforts there to put people into places where they can occasionally hear a male bugling in the fall or whatnot. So there are some elk viewing opportunities. Moose are still too scarce. I mean, a handful of moose in the Northeast to have anything regular. And wolves, of course, despite the comments by some of our hunters who called in and your friend who saw wolves during the hunting season, going to point A and expecting to see a wolf like you might at Yellowstone just isn't the case. Plus, Yellowstone's topography is such that you can look across huge vistas of landscape and see all sorts of animals like this. But the relevance, getting back to our Christmas list, is there are all sorts of great guides, the Great Birding and Nature Trail guides, which are now complete. There are five of them for the state. Great stocking stuffers. You should get out there and get these Great Birding and Nature Trail guides, which take you to the very best places in the state to see birds.
Perfect.
And other wildlife. So great thing for that emailer and for anybody who's looking for something to stuff in the stockings this year.
And Scott, always a pleasure. We'll look forward to your first Wednesday of 2010.
We're out of time? That can't be. Well, have a great holiday. I'll be back next year.
Thanks, Scott. Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, our guest, and he'll be back the first Wednesday of January. I wonder if that falls. Does that fall on January 1st? I'll have to check and see. I'm not sure. It might be on New Year's Day. You never know. You know, we have Mad Dog and Merrill coming on our program, our grilling buddies, tomorrow. And if you go online to our community of listeners, go to WPR.org. Right near my picture, you'll see a little note for that. And if you've got some ideas for what you'd like them to cook on your grill, I hope you will put those in, enter them in, our community of listeners online. We'd love to have that. So what's on your grill? Mad Dog and Merrill are on the program tomorrow at 11:45. At 11, we'll talk about some money lessons that Michael Collins, Associate Professor of Consumer Sciences, has for us. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.